Before we enjoy listening and meeting with each other online, I want to acknowledge that the digital environment in which we have these conversations is incorporated in and amongst the traditional territories of the Algonquin, the Malahat, the Pachidot, the Skiinu, the Atsayok, and Wasanich peoples. We have a responsibility to work towards truth and reconciliation and are open to suggestions and dialogue with local First Nations communities to learn how our industry, sector, and community can better support and facilitate economic and cultural reconciliation. Good afternoon, everyone. It is now afternoon, I think 12:01, and welcome to the inaugural meeting of the Creator Content Club. Many have asked me, many have said, what the hell is this? And why form the Creator Content Club? Interested and curious individuals, many of whom are participating on the Zoom call, fit the profile of the everyday creator. What I have found out to be an exploding segment of the digital economy. These are folks who do not have a bazillion followers. We are not influencers. Perhaps some of you are. At least I'm not. But very much wish to learn how to create better digital content. Very much wish to monetize our digital content. And very much wish to learn how to market our digital content. So I looked around and it's darn hard, if not impossible, to find information on how to do all that. So Kelly and Darwin and I, with Al's and the Chamber's support, formed the Creator Content Club to help answer these questions and share networks, information, and services amongst each other and a broader community. The club will follow a speaker-based format with regular meetings together with a Facebook community. There's no formal organization. There's no costs. Interested folks are on a mailing list. We'll try to share experiences, questions, and stories. So I looked around the region, and exploding on our scene and on an international scene was our speaker for today, Tyler Funk of Vancouver-based North of Now Digital Consultant Agency. Tyler has won acclaim as both a filmmaker and digital content creator, showcasing his work at SXSW and other international festivals. His short-form digital series, White Ninja, featuring actor-comedian Paul Scheer, was among the honorees at the 2016 Webby Awards. Founder and creative director of North of Now, a creative production and digital consultant agency based out of Vancouver. Yay, Vancouver! And for the past 3 years has filmed ads all across North America. He's produced commercials for Coca-Cola, Lego, and other major brands. With Anything for Fame, which I have watched now a couple times, and of course forms sort of the thrust of the content for today's discussion. Your first feature documentary, you take a deep dive into contemporary internet culture. Hi, Tyler, and welcome to our band of everyday creators. And my first question to you, I guess you've become now a celebrity. You've become an influencer. And so would love to know how life has been since you not published, but that you, what's the word? The word is that you've, that when you released Anything for Now, just a moment. And also, so I'd like to know that. And then also, if you could give us, let's say, one, two, or three sort of overarching messages or learning experiences from what's been happening now.
Of course, yeah. And thank you, everyone, for attending. And I look forward to chatting with each and every one of you. Please file off any questions. And if we don't get to it today, I'm usually around. You can shoot me an email. So how has things changed since the film coming out? You know, we launched the film originally on Paramount Plus in Canada and around the world. And then 6 months later, we did a screening and we released on the NFB platform. We've been getting some great press in the CBC, CTV nationally, some really strong, you know, people are really responding to the film, which is fantastic. For me personally, you know, I'm not the focus of the film. I personally am, you know, I actually prefer documentaries where you don't see the filmmaker that much. Because I think the subjects are more interesting. I think everyone in the film is infinitely more interesting than I am. What it's done for me, like any big project, if you publish a book or you make a film, it's a set of keys that opens other conversations and doors and opportunities to pitch stuff, right? And so there's a bunch of shows, reality shows, factual documentary shows that I'm pitching now to different networks and different conversations that are happening in that world. But that world, when you're pitching a multi-million dollar series, takes time. Things move slow. Anything for Fame took a while to get going, right? And that's on the smaller scale for sure. So that's going on there. My advice for young creators or creators of beginning their careers, there's a few different elements. One is I think there's a lot of people that make money off it being a gold rush. And that's why I was interested in being here. It's a free thing, everyone gets to participate. There's a lot of people selling you courses, there's a lot of people selling ring lights and cameras and all this stuff. And that's where they're making their money. There's actually the amount of people making a living on YouTube is extremely small. We met a few of them, and a lot of them were still working other jobs, even though they had a million followers. And the algorithms often change. So you can be making a lot of money one year, and the next year they've changed how they're paying out their ads. What we see a lot is little mini gold rushes where, to incentivize creators, X or TikTok or Instagram will have spend downs. So they'll give out money to creators, but it's only for a quarter or two. Right? Their job is to get content all the time. They're like a thrift store, right? They just want content. They have different levers because they have a ton of money that they'll put forward, but they're not interested in providing you a career. And even the most experienced YouTubers, people in the 5 to 10 million range, you'll often see have different side hustles. Mr. Beast, for example, the most popular YouTuber, makes most of his money by selling chocolate bars and Beast Burgers and all that. All of his YouTube revenues going back in to make his YouTube videos, right? Now he's worth $1 billion, but he's been very smart of building out from YouTube. And it's not necessarily about the YouTube revenue. It's how he's used that platform to launch his other businesses. And that's, he's one in, I think, what is there, 2 billion YouTube accounts? I don't think people understand the numbers often of how few people are really making that kind of money, but that's a great headline. So you'll see it in Forbes. You'll see it all the time. You'll see a kid made $21 million on YouTube. You could too. And that's a narrative the platforms need because they need content creation. So I don't think from a monetary perspective, I think it's really hard to do. I know many people have tried, done a ton of research and have failed. I know a few people that have succeeded. I think the gift of content creation online is the community you'll become a part of, the friends you'll make, and the other opportunities it'll open up. So I think we should definitely participate, create videos, create content, and share and communicate with others. I think if you think it's going to get you away from your 9 to 5 and change your life and make you $1 million, you're likely to experience the journey that some creators in our film went on. And that's part of the reason we made the film. So sorry, I feel like I'm rambling here, but that's my.
No, fabulous stuff. Thank you. Yeah. Go
Wait,
ahead,
who is
keep
that
rambling.
too? From my perspective, so I have a marketing agency, and we work with influencers from the other side of it, where we have a chocolate bar to sell, so we go out and we find the right person, and those prices, you can hire an influencer for a free chocolate bar or $10,000 for a story. Like it's all over the place, and it just to call it the Wild West is it doesn't even do it justice, because there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to how things work, and necessarily what makes one person famous and one person not, or an influencer and a not, or a successful one maybe is
Yeah,
the
it's
better
very
way.
subjective, right? And like our film kind of, one surefire way to be famous is to be provocative. I think we've seen that with the rise of many different political movements also, right? Like that's a way to gain popularity. The problem as a content creator, and you see this in our film, is you inevitably cross a line. If your entertainment is by one-upping yourself each time, you will get views a lot faster, and you'll get an audience a lot faster. But inevitably, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure because you can't forever do the crazier, crazier, crazier thing. And so I think a lot of people, when they start in their career, should really think about like, what am I offering to the audience? And can I do that for a long period of time? Right? I don't think going viral in itself is that hard if you're willing to cross certain social barriers. But I think going viral in a way that we would want, most of us want to be seen and represented, is quite challenging.
And you see that with was it Jumanji in the film, put so much effort and one-ups himself every single time, and at the end of the day, or 2 years later, he hasn't made a career out of it, and probably
Yeah.
would have made more if he'd kept his way job than if he had done you know, what he did when he was working there.
Yeah, and he wouldn't have gone to jail multiple times, right? And it's a lot of damage to your friends and family, right? So I think that's the question for every content creator, is like, what are you actually selling? And I don't think it could be, you can't count on the views to be your revenue because it's so unreliable. So if your goal is to do stuff, you know, and you know, maybe you sell, you know, some pet item or something like that. You get into that niche, you get into that world, but you focus on your product and what you're selling, right? And that's where I've seen great success. But those are people more that are marketers using the platforms. Because I think in general, social media is just that. It's an advertising platform that you can try and sell something on, but the platforms themselves are not looking to hire filmmakers or creatives. You know, you're actually much more likely the traditional film route of going to the National Film Board, Telefilm, CMF, those funding bodies, or Czech TV to get your show going. You know, like those are the sources that are actually trying to fund content. I don't really believe that the platforms are.
We struggle to find sources of information on how to, you know, work with our content online. I know there are tons of videos about that, but they're generally not terribly helpful. And unless you have a lot of views, etc., have you been inclined to do anything for Fame Part 2 or Part 3 that potentially focuses on different areas of influencing and look at this group is here really primarily as maybe small business content creators, everyday creators, and we'll never get the bazillions, but we'll use the internet and the digital marketing tools to help them build their business. Do you see that as something you might be focusing on in the future?
No, I don't think so. And respectfully, I think it would be just not entertaining enough, right? Like we chose high risk individuals because we thought that was the best way to get into the dialogue, right? Yeah. Like we chose people really interested in fame. I think, you know, there are resources of community colleges. Dr. Jamie Cohen, who's in the film, you know, he teaches a course in New York on being a social media influencer. It's the first one in a university in North America. And there's lots of great podcasts, I think, that cover that information. But from a narrative doc perspective, I don't think there's enough drama. I don't think there's enough entertainment value. I don't think I'd go down that path.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you answered that way. And here, I want to open up the floor, but do you find that there's any region that's beginning to focus more and more on this than other regions? So naturally, I would suspect the West Coast of Canada, because of you, is now becoming a center of influence in this industry. Is that the case, or is it just doesn't matter because we're all online?
We found throughout the film and our research that in general, what the model from Hollywood still exists. The majority of the money and the talent is in Hollywood. And a lot of our influencers had to keep going down to Hollywood to try and work with other people to get their views up. And the dream was all to get to traditional media to get a steady paycheck from a TV show. You know, we shot 70 days across North America and we spent about 33 in LA, and not by choice. I don't really love LA. People just kept going down there and we wanted to see what was going on in their stories. So those traditional forces are huge. And same, right? Like if you're an influencer in Toronto, you're going to get offered better brand deals than if you're an influencer in Vancouver, just by the fact of the Canadian, you know, the economy. Like there's so much more money spent on the ad space in Toronto. My production company North of Now, you know, we shoot a lot of ads for big brands. We're always working with agencies in LA or Chicago. We've never gotten hired out of Vancouver. And, you know, the conversations we've had with some of the agencies in Vancouver is their budgets are extremely low to the point of they're expecting filmmakers to do them for free. And obviously there are other agencies that are good here that do that, but they tend to have their vendors they've used for the last two decades. It's a very hard world to break into. In LA, Chicago, New York, there is so much work that needs to get done. They're much more open to bids from anyone if they have a good reel and a good set of examples.
Yeah. Hey, anyone from the floor want to jump in? I do have other questions, and so does Kelly, but if you'd like to participate, please go ahead. Just turn on and talk. Okay.
I'll love to talk to Tyler here.
Yay.
Tyler, Pleasure to meet you. Pleasure to meet everyone here. I see a few familiar faces from local Victoria. My name is Gordon, obviously, says here in Zoom. And I run a pretty niche podcast called The Restaurant Growth Show. And we're focused on restaurant technology to help restaurateurs grow their business by leveraging technology. My co-host and I have a very small following so far. So, Tyler, my question to you is, in your studies throughout, you know, creating this film and talking to so many creators out there, in what way would a podcast really, in your mind, be able to grow and flourish the most organically?
Yeah, you know, I think about it a lot as, you know, I'd read this business article once about restaurants, and there's a tension, you know, people are like, hey, I love this food. I'm really good at cooking this food. I want to open this type of restaurant in this neighborhood. And they typically open up, they go out of business shortly thereafter. And they think because no one's like they're out there, it's going to succeed. And podcasts and YouTube channels are the same. Mm-hmm. See who's succeeding. Copy what they're doing. Don't try and invent the wheel by yourself, right? What's the closest thing to you and how can you take their best elements? Mm-hmm. I think too often people get a little bit too lost on being unique and their own thing, but really you want to say, hey, that's my comparable. There's an audience. I can see they get a million listens every week. People want that kind of content. Mm-hmm. I'm going to share content like that. Mm-hmm. And that's the successful YouTubers we saw. They actually spent 6 months researching YouTube, being like, where could I make money? Where are the views? Right. And they bounced around to different things until they're like, oh, people like this type of content. I can add a slight twist in it. Right. You're still going to bring yourself, which no one's going to ever replicate. It's still going to be yours. Mm-hmm. But I think you really want to pay attention to what is that podcast you want to be. Right. And if it's a comedy podcast, well, then you got to start doing a comedy podcast. You're right.
I'm just not that funny.
It's any of those things you can learn. Right. You know, and again, like, I pursue your passion, but see who's doing your passion better than you. Right. That's what I always try and look for. I'm like, who's making documentary films that I wish I was making? Those are the films I watch and I steal from. And mm-hmm. I think, that's the gift of the internet, right? We have this amazing library of content. And there's lists. If you want to see the most popular podcast today, you can check, right? That information's out there. Mm-hmm. Go through the top 10. Which one of those could you be a little bit more like? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest key. From what we saw.
That's great advice. Thank you.
Right on. Anybody else? Nicola? Hi.
Hey, Tyler. Hello. And hello, group. I kind of like Gordon, I have a podcast, but it's with Radio Sydney, which is an online radio station. We're building our brand. And my podcast, at least one of my shows with Radio Sydney, is a storytelling, true crime, mystery, and supernatural storytelling podcast with a psychic twist. I am a psychic. I tell a story, and the psychic tries to tell the story in advance of what I'm saying and solve it. And cool. What I'm wondering is, we generally have about an hour-long session, and I'm now putting it onto YouTube as a podcast, but not just simple icon for the visual. It's mainly just obviously audio. And I'm wondering two things. Is it really important, do you think, to, from the YouTube perspective, to have, you know, really stunning videos, video content, in other words, the visual, or is it plain audio okay? And number two, what kind of duration lengths would you say are best for this kind of content?
Yeah, so I think the visuals, like, you want a catchy thumbnail. People are scrolling through tons of stuff. I do think that's important. I think it's important, though, that it gets people excited. It doesn't have to be over the top. I think even some of the top YouTubers talked about, they spent more money on camera gear, producing high-end visuals. They didn't get better views. The beautiful thing is you could upload your podcast 10 different times with 10 different cover photos and see which one gets the most views, right? Like, treat it as, be a bit scientific about it, right? That's, who cares? The one that got the less views, just delete them, right? No one knows or cares. And start doing some of that research. Start thinking like that. Start thinking like, oh, they're giving you a lot of data, right? Like, YouTube is giving you a lot of information. Where people are dropping off? You could edit it 5 different lengths. Put it up. See what happens, right? Try different times of the day until you start to really notice what's working best for you. And that's where I think by looking at the people in your category and copying what you're doing will save you some of that time, yeah. Right? Because you're like, okay, these, you know, we got to have the psychic in the thumbnail. That seems to be really important. Or we know that our audio quality is not as good as theirs. Maybe our audiences are stopped listening because of that, right? Like, I do think audio quality is much more important than video quality.
Okay.
People will turn off bad audio. Bad video, people will tolerate if they're invested in the story, you know? That's the approach I would take. And I'd look too at like, how can you keep those stories local, but also make sure they have that global impact, right? Like, how can people feel about it from the community, but also from around the world? You know, tell me more about Sydney. I'm curious, even though if I'm listening down in Florida.
Okay, thank you.
That's great. Any more questions? Yeah, Al, go ahead.
I find this all fascinating. I watched the film when John set it out, so thanks for that. It was really fun to, I had to get a membership on Paramount Plus on my Apple TV to watch it, but you know, whatever. I was worth it.
You got 7 days, cancel it.
It's like, it's actually, I was gonna and forgot. So now I have it for a month, even though I've canceled it, which is what they count on, damn it. But I find the interesting what you said earlier about a lot of the large creators making money off the back end side of things. I think that's, just to give you a background, me, I've been an entrepreneur forever. I've had software companies and manufacturing companies, all that kind of stuff. But I also had a 5-year career as a daily YouTuber. And so it was super fun when I did it. And I only did it because my mom was passing away and I wanted to share stuff with her. And every time I sent her videos, it was like a bad tech call with your grandma to try and talk her through how to see something I was trying to show her. And one of my buddies was like, just put it on YouTube. And then she just has to click it, get her an iPad. I was like, oh my God, brilliant. So I did. And after it, she was supposed to pass away in 3 months and she lasted 5 years, which made it a big work project for me. But at the end of the day, I ended up with like 20,000 subscribers for just doing something I love. And if you look at like I'm always talking to my mom and I think people took that as me talking to them, which I didn't realize. Someone pointed that out to me later. Anyway, I've stopped doing that like 5 years ago. So, cause she passed away finally and I could quit. But I learned a lot of fun things. And I think the interesting thing is I learned about the fact that most people make their money off of brand deals on the back end. So my question to you would be, for anyone who's thinking about doing this, and I've got a couple other projects coming that next year or in a couple of years that might utilize a lot of the same stuff, is what kind of things specifically are spot people who will look at your content, and what are they caring about? Maybe Kelly can chime in here too. I think it's interesting to think that in one way, we're creating stuff because we're all creatives and we love to create. In another way, we need to get paid for it if you want that to be your reality. And so how do you bridge that creating for you or creating for advertisers? Because the only way we're going to make money is if somebody thinks our audience is worth it, or like, what are they looking for specifically as we build up what we love? What should we be looking for to pair that up and make a great relationship?
Yeah, I think it's really fickle. I think what advertisers are looking for changes a lot. And I see that because we do ads and we get briefs and they want this type of influencer or that type of influencer. I think there's the obvious red flags, though, of like, if you're very polarizing on certain things or saying, you know, offensive stuff, no advertiser is going to touch you, right? And it's you'll get more views, maybe. You know, it's our rooftoppers from the film, right? Like those guys, they make like very little money for their videos. I think like World Star was paying like a few hundred dollars, even though those videos were getting millions of views and they were literally risking their lives, right? No advertiser wants to touch that because it's such a liability, right? Like, you don't want if someone gets hurt, your brand to be a part of that, right? So they're never going to go near that. Whereas if you're in the financial space and, you know, giving people advice on retirement or savings, you know, that's a safer space to be in, right? Banks are going to need people that people trust to talk about financial products, right? So I think about it that way a lot, of like looking at yourself, your profile, who are you, and, you know, would a brand feel comfortable being attached to you, right? Because that is, even on some of the bigger commercials that we direct and produce, just for the actors, sometimes the agencies will want to go through their socials before they hire them, right? And just get an idea. And, you know, I think it's ridiculous because it's, you know, we're hiring actors to be actors. We're not judging people's lives here. But the reality is that they do that, you know, like they do that, and brands can be very, you know, so, and I think there's a way to cultivate good content. And I think if you focus, you know, on not punching down, not kind of making fun of others, I think there's a way you can create good content, add value, and brands will see that, right? Like, I don't think brands are inherently bad or evil or anything. they're just protecting themselves, right? And so I think if your content's something positive in the world, if it's something that promotes positive change, I think brands will notice and participate in that once the followers are there.
We have a question from Paul, who is down at my bottom of the screen. He says, how important is it to have a predictable cadence for your audience? What is too much? What is too little? I see some that post daily, which is overwhelming, and some monthly, which can lead to them dropping off my radar.
Honestly, I think the question more is, what can you do to avoid burnout? Because if you're making content, there's so much content being produced every day, you need to put your voice out, you need to participate. That's where I think a lot of people like X or Twitter, right? Because you can engage in conversations, you can make jokes, you can make little videos, it's a little less labor intensive. It's a lot of work to make videos. I think avoiding burnout is the most important thing, because who cares if you're doing a video every day and then you stop making them because you need to take 6 months off, right? So I think it's a personal question. And I think it's about figuring out realistically and being honest with yourself. I'm willing to give this much time to see if this project works, right? Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I really encourage people to change their strategies. I think often I see people, they have 100 YouTube videos and they're all stuck at 100 views or, and I was like, well, it didn't work after the first five. It's not going to work after the next 95. Right. And you have this amazing feedback thing. The internet is very quick at being very vocal if it likes or dislikes something. Mm-hmm. And instead of being afraid or trying to teach people about that, participate in that conversation. Right. Like that's a gift to be able to have as a filmmaker. I don't get that. I rarely hear, we get some critics, but I can't change. The film's done. As making social media content, I think there's a little more room to engage in that dance.
Yeah. I'm doing a sort of this pause to allow folks to jump in, but I have a question for you, Tyler, about the movie. There were five participants, five influencers, two female, three male. The two females ended up eventually generating money from OnlyFans, which frankly predominantly is exposing, making money off one's body, pictures of one's body. The males were in that sort of crazy risk your life category, and you just got to get crazier and crazier and crazier all the time. Why did you pick those two categories, and would you do that again?
Yeah, I think what we found through our research is the internet pushes people into stereotypes. And that's there's a bit about the end of the film about us. We need to be better viewers, right? OnlyFans did, I think, $5.4 billion in revenue last year. The Hollywood box office did $5.8 billion. If you're spending that much money on OnlyFans, that's going to encourage young female creators to go down that path. Mm-hmm. We need to be better as consumers to change that habit. I can't fault anyone for making any content. I think OnlyFans is the gift in the sense of that content creators are actually getting paid. That's a good thing. Yeah. People paying for content is a good thing. People, competing for views by doing more dangerous stuff is how the platform is set up. It's part of the platform. You're going to get pushed to the top of the feeds. And then young males predominantly are willing to do those physical risks, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And they're pushed to be the worst, the most stereotypical version of that, right? Because you're trying to one-up yourself. You're trying to be the most hardcore. You're trying to take the biggest risks. Again, I think with the rise of YouTube and Napster, when we stop paying for content, we've created a really problematic scenario, right? There's something good about paying for content because that encourages good content, right? When you go see an Oscar-nominated film, that gets more Oscar-nominated films made. If people aren't willing to go to the movies, but they're willing to spend on OnlyFans, that's the world we're going to be in. And if people only share the rooftopper, but they don't share the post of your aunt's garden, then we're going to get more rooftoppers, right? And so it's what world do we want? And that's, as viewers, our responsibility of what we share and what we bring attention to online. And I think, I really hope the film encourages individuals to think about that, because people often lie about that. You ask people, everyone says, I just watch cat videos, YouTube, whatever. TikTok knows, OnlyFans knows, the stats are there, right? Same with the rooftoppers, the stats are there. People want to see people risk their lives. Mm-hmm. And there's models that where it kind of works, like Cirque du Soleil, right? Like none of this is new. These are very similar patterns we've seen for years. The problem is we're removing any pay or safety features for the talent.
Right. And it's interesting because the internet exists off of those same human behaviors that are driving all the stuff that we complain about. The only reason we have the internet today is because of seedy underpinnings, not necessarily because we decided it was a great thing for society.
Yeah, and I think our task, our generation, you know, all of us now that are is so involved, is how do we make it better, right? How do we have meetups like this? How do we use it for, you know, I think the internet was such a gift through the pandemic, how we were able to use Zoom, right? Like, I think people forget about how crucial the internet was of getting us all through that.
Yeah.
And that power. And how do we focus on that power a bit more in our day-to-day lives? And it could be just reaching out to friends, right? Like building community, because you can get so isolated all the time when you're just staring at Instagram and everyone's life is better than yours. You know, like Instagram by default, you know, there's a lot of studies on how bad it is on your mental health. Like, I encourage most people to get rid of it. I don't think it, you know, I have it, but I try and barely use it more as a messaging app. Like, if you're just looking at people's best moments, you're not going to feel good about yourself, right? Because it's not necessarily a communication tool. It's congratulations, congratulations, congratulations. Wow, that's amazing. How does that make you feel, right? So I think we need to try and take back these tools a little bit and make sure they work for us.
Amazing how much the algorithms amplify that, right? Like, somebody jumping off a roof is going to get more hits because more people look at it than the 6 months I tried to grow a piece of broccoli in my garden during the pandemic. It just wasn't as popular. But if we all start doing that, and from what I'm taking from what you said, is we try to create that better internet. It's each individual one of us has to do that. It's not up to Facebook or Meta or whoever to do that. We have to put the decent content out there to fight the stupid content.
Yeah, I think we need to get away from staring at the car crash. I think there's a little bit of everyone slowing down their car, looking at the car crash, saying, hey, what's going on in there? I want to see a body. We need to get away from that and use it more as the, hey, how are you, my neighbor? Hey, we haven't talked since high school. I miss you. What's going on? Right? Like, that's what I think is important, is what are those connections we're having? Are we staring at people and laughing that they're freaks? We don't want to be doing that. That's not a good way to encourage content to be made, right? Or looking at the car crash. You know, we really want to use it to connect with people that are like-minded, to connect with community. And so I think it's a little bit of thinking about how you use the videos. What do you like? What do you actually stare at? And putting in the effort to comment when someone does do something and they're trying to reach out, that they're in your community, you know, and that can make a really positive space.
So is there a tipping point to this? Like, is there a point where we go, okay, we've seen enough car crashes, or is this algorithm just going to keep feeding that particular content until the day we stop looking at it?
You know, it'll be really interesting. In a way, there's this notion of content icebergs. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with. An iceberg, you see a little bit on top and there's layers down. And the internet's like that, right? You can go down a rabbit hole of how dark and deep and crazy stuff you want to watch, right? And back in the days, kind of, you know, when I was in university, you kind of had the rise of videos such as Two Girls, One Cup taking over the internet, right? And I'd actually think some of that really extreme stuff we've gotten rid of, to be honest, you know, is more likely early days YouTube, you could see beheadings and stuff like that was being uploaded. The platforms have gotten better at removing those videos, like, because of people complaining, right? It used to be a lot more of a Wild West at the beginning of some of the content and some of the sites that just had really, really dark content. I think that is gradually changing, right? Even, you know, a great example, I think, is Vine, right? When Vine started out, it was kind of a nothing app, not much was going on. And then people started using it to share pornography and it blew up in popularity. And then they realized that that's not the IPO route they wanted to go. They started shutting that down. People started doing it for the Vine, which was these stunts, right? And then some guy got hit trying to jump over a car, broke his leg. And they started cleaning that up. And the thing is, the platforms aren't good or bad. They're just chasing eyeballs. But there needs to be people that are complaining or switch their eyeballs for the platforms to change. And that's where, like, I'm optimistic. I love the internet. I think it is getting better all the time. I think it's just a slow process and one that requires work.
Within, assuming that human nature will always be human nature, and that we will always generally react in a certain way, which is proven out by some of the discussion we've just had, I'm optimistic, but I'm also, I think, a realist. But notwithstanding that we are what we are there some emerging trends that that you have become familiar with in terms of, are we seeing more training videos? Are we seeing more travel video? Are we seeing more music and art videos? Like, are there industries that are moving on and taking advantage of digital content that you've become aware of since you've made the film and new research, et cetera?
Yeah, there'll always be new ones. Like, it goes so fast. Human NPCs is like a trend that popped up after the film that we did not capture within the film, which is basically people pretending to be like a side character in a video game. And it's like pretty dehumanizing, but it's kind of like sexual fetish play. But we're seeing a lot of those videos on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. That trend just blew up out of nowhere. And in some ways in comedy ways, but we saw that like emerge. There's always gonna be a different trend like that. Like, that's, you know, it's a conversation with multi-billion people. Different stuff's always gonna pop up, you know, and I think if the goal is to be as popular as you know, as popular as possible, yeah, you see creators that just jump trend to trend to trend, right? Again, I think you gotta think, what does it work for you and what's your end goal? Who do you want to be online? What's the product you're selling? Does your content support that? How can you see who else is in your category doing better and learn from them?
Can I jump in and ask a question to bring you back to strategies and changing one's strategies from a marketing perspective, Tyler? Given that you had mentioned, for example, somebody had, you know, 100 videos and no video was getting more than 100 hits. And so that might be a disaster considered. Why keep creating? What I wanted to understand is, given the massive amount of content that's being produced daily onto YouTube, the difficulty being discovered, are you deliberately a failure if you're not getting more than 100 views, for example, because no. You're not being discovered, or is it because your content sucks? Like, how do you know what the reality is?
I think the reality is it's really, really hard, right? That's the reality. And just by numbers, if you have 2 million YouTube accounts, how many can possibly get views every day? If you think about it, right? Like, how many people can actually, it's like anything, like how many people actually get to be the one we all stare at, right? Like, there's just a numbers game at the end of the day. I think it helps if you set expectations, what are good for you? You know, if that 100 people are close friends, passionate fans, people you connect with, that's a valuable 100 people, right? If your goal is growth and generating more and more money, yeah, I would be saying, hey, 100 is not acceptable. I'm not gonna make a living off of this. I need to change stuff. But I think it's being realistic about your goals. I think it's, you know, film and media also is incredibly hard. Honestly, anything in the arts, you know, any content creation element, I think you have to love more than it loves you. It is never going to be easy. You're going to doubt yourself all the time. And I don't think it really gets better. So you got to have good friends to go, you know, hang out with afterwards and laugh about it.
Okay.
That's great. You're awfully wise for such a young man, Tyler.
I mean, these are just my opinions. I could be wrong about everything.
Any questions? I have one. Oh, Gordon. Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to comment, you know, as a marketer, no, Tyler, you're absolutely not wrong. Having done this for as long as I have in a bunch of different industries, you know, having 100 followers, whether it's a podcast, a YouTube channel, or just a business, if they're loyal followers, you're going to be fulfilled, whether that's from a monetary standpoint or just all the good feels. It's all about building a loyal following that has engagement. Personally, our podcast is just a positioning play for our tech startup. So we're not trying to monetize this channel. But what we have found is that this is a unique way for us to stand out as a company and provide a platform for other guests with professionals in similar industries that can come and have their say. And that's where we're generating energy and we're generating conversation. It's not necessarily a direct line of attribution to our bottom line. However, we are building a very positive following and there's good energy around the show and around the company as a result. So this whole idea of being an influencer and monetizing your channel, I think is a terrible play. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at, Tyler. And for us, again, it's a positioning play. Like, who are we? Why are we saying what we have to say? And, you know, people should participate in that conversation.
Yeah, it's an amazing organic way to network in a very human way, right? Like, that's a great thing about a podcast. You get these deep conversations, like the chance I get to talk to everyone here today, right? Like 10 people from around the country, we all get a chat. Like, that's awesome, right? Like, that's fantastic. And I think that's you know, like, seeing those values. Because, yeah, the way of being the influencer or getting your views and running it, like, it's doable. It's just incredibly hard. And a lot of people have incentives to make it feel much easier. If they're selling you something along the way, you know, Canon selling their new camera that's for vloggers, you know, whatever it is, whichever company, you know, Lacey, new hard drives on the go while you're vlogging, all this stuff that you need, the new MacBook Pro, right? And at a certain day, you're like, if it's a business, you got to look at the numbers. If it's a hobby, then yeah, jump, you know, that's a different journey. But yeah, I think it's an amazing networking tool, having a podcast or a show, and just can be really fun. Right. And I think that's what's important, is everyone should check in. If, like, if you're not having fun, if you're feeling, you know, don't do it, you know? And I think too many people go on a little bit too long not having fun, but hoping there's some payday. And I'm just not convinced that's a healthy approach.
Yeah. It's not healthy for any business. If you're not having fun, fundamentally your chances of succeeding are pretty low. I have a question. Anyone else have one? They'd like to. So sort of bulk of my digital content activity is around a issues-based vodcast called the Victoria Rumble Room. And we publish weekly, and we interview weekly, and it's all about sort of political stuff. And it's reached, I'd say, about 1.6 million cumulative views in a couple of years. So there's somebody's watching and listening, okay? We haven't monetized it in large part because we haven't wanted to. We've not tried to. We enjoy it. Okay, so that's that thing. What we're doing, so we're increasingly becoming relevant. So people are listening. We're getting more viewers. Meanwhile, mainstream journalism, mainstream, you know, isn't it's sort of falling apart. These huge companies that used to create a lot of content and sell it by magazines or stuff, TV, they are shutting down. So I'd love to hear your opinion based on now. I mean, you are a influencer and expert in this area. That's a given. Where do you see journalism going? And can it even survive? Or will there be a million little, you know, podcasts like mine and Kelly's and Gordon's kicking around?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about journalism. I'll give you my opinion, but I honestly, like, I think it does feel like it's decentralizing dramatically. You know, I've just from some talks to people at CBC, CTV, the cutbacks and all of that, right? We're getting decentralized a lot. And obviously I think the challenge there is you get, you know, unfact check stuff, you get such a variety of stuff. You get people living in different realities. And it'll be an interesting challenge, right? It'll be a really interesting challenge. I don't imagine that suddenly traditional media is going to come back, right? Like, it doesn't feel like suddenly, and that's it's like people are not paying for cable subscriptions. And that was a big part of where that money came in for all of that, right? And people aren't paying for newspapers. So I get it. If there's no money for that, you know, level of journalism, there's going to be more of the local podcast. And, you know, maybe that could be a really good thing, right? Like, maybe we have local people that know their communities better rather than, you know, a head office in Toronto telling us the news across the nation. Maybe we focus on our local news and we hold people accountable at a local level and we rise to better journalism. You know, maybe we go that way. Who knows? Yeah.
Nicola and I have chatted over the years. She's interviewed me for the work I've done out on the peninsula. And she's part of a group called Radio Sydney, which is an online radio station. And they've taken I think the business model being that there are these centers of influence and interest. So Nicola was representing a center of influence and interest sort of, and is being helped by Radio Sydney to distribute that message. And I don't know And I don't know whether you don't have to say it, but are they monetizing, or they must be making some money? Is it? I'm just curious about the model, not about the answer.
Are you curious? You're talking about Radio Sydney?
Yeah. That being, you know, this sort of new way of journalism, so to speak.
Yeah, I would say we're not being monetized in any way. It's all volunteer at the moment. Of course, there's some, you know, we have donations, some money coming in, but we're really slowly building. We have content, but we're online, and it's because we're local, it would be really excellent to be on air, literally. And we're looking to get that on-air developer's license that might give us the localized 5-mile antenna, you know, distance. And then we would really be able to, I think, be much more in tune with our population, because this idea of being online is a bit distant, I find. People don't really think of radio in their internet, although they think of podcasts. They don't necessarily think of streaming radio and, you know, your chat for the day, or your little garden show, or whatever it is locally. So, no, we're not making big money now, but we have great plans.
Okay. Yeah, Al, go, please.
Two things. One, I love your opinion on that Bill C-11 stuff and how you think that's going to impact this creative space. Because regardless of whether people are getting paid, they're still creating, and they're reliant on those YouTubes or the algorithms and stuff to build the following in order to be able to start making money. Because really, it's just like Facebook. Facebook had to build a following, and now they're still trying to figure out how to monetize it enough to make it a useful company. It doesn't actually make that much money in the long run as a company. It made a bunch of money for the shareholders who all got bought out and all that stuff. But as far as a profitable company, it took forever. And I feel like creators are in the same game. You got to build a following, and then you learn to monetize your following, much like an artist, right? Like you got a musician, you got to build a following before you start making money and getting paid for your concerts and filling seats and all that kind of stuff. So I would love to hear your idea on, do you think that C-11 bill is going to impact those creators? Because now a lot of Canadian creators are under the same kind of structure as the more traditional style, as far as being seen and what their content should be and can be, and what incentives the government's going to give to people to promote Canadian over not. Anyway, it's just interesting to me. So I'd love your opinion on that.
Yeah, my personal opinion is, like, I actually think a lot of those concerns are kind of propaganda by the streamers, or the platforms, rather. I think they should be paying to create more Canadian content, just like all the other ones are. Other countries have done it, Australia, all that, right? Like, it's actually, Canada's not great at protecting our content, whereas the British are really good at that, and the BBC shows that, you know, where we kind of let the Americans just run all their content in here. And I think if people are going to be predominantly watching stuff on YouTube, YouTube can definitely spend more money on making Canadian content. I don't think they need to judge the content. Again, like anything for fame, if you watch it, or sorry, you have watched it. I mean, but for anyone who hasn't, it's not really a Canadian film per se, right? Like we're shot in America. We're a Canadian team. And that was fully funded by the National Film Board, right? Like there's actually tons of freedoms to make content that isn't your cliche Canadian boring content. And I think that there's a bit of an overblown fear there that there's, you know, and there was an active ad campaign by Facebook, by YouTube about that, saying, oh no, they're going to ruin everything. You love your YouTubers. You're not going to get them. Look who we created. And that's just them not wanting to pay their taxes. It's them not wanting to pay to the CRTC what all the cable companies have had to pay for years.
But isn't there a fine line in that bill between the concept of promoting Canadian content, as far as your content is about Canadian things, versus a Canadian creating content? And it seems to be there's even still confusion in the bill that could go either way, depending on how they play that. Like I read through the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, you probably know better than I do. I just know like our film, Anything for Fame, I don't know if we even mentioned the word Canada in it. And that was National Film Board. So I'm not too concerned, you know, like I think we have a maple leaf on a guy's hat, you know, but it's like, in my experience as a content creator, as long as your CAVCO numbers are correct, and that's, you know, how many people on the team are Canadian, the content itself, and obviously Doc's more forgiving the narrative, right? But I would assume that YouTubers would fall under Doc category more so, right? Because they're not, maybe if they're doing narrative, because I know narrative stuff's a little different, but we'll see. I think ultimately more money for Canadian creators is going to be a good thing. Like I don't think you can trust the platforms on their own to provide, because they haven't to date, and they've been around for quite a while.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't have too much time left, and you have a hard stop, Tyler. You got to leave at one. And as I suppose others do, any final questions or thoughts, remarks for Tyler? Sue, yeah, please.
You were quite strong about not liking Instagram. I've got a son who's working with me on my business who's telling me, Mom, you got to be there. You got to be on Instagram. Well, can you tell us more about why you're...
For sure. For sure. I think as a marketing place, it's great, right? Like that's how it was originally designed. It was, I think, a drink reviewing app, right? And restaurants, and it was like fancy photography, and it was better than everywhere else, right? So if you're selling a product, fantastic. Make a presence on there. You want to show this glamorous lifestyle that everyone wants. That makes total sense. I think from a personal level, and you know, there's a lot of studies too of young women and higher rates of anorexia, suicide. It's not a healthy space to be, I think, necessarily as a teenager, to be comparing yourself to others all the time. Again, you're seeing a curated feed of other people's lives. When you hang out with your friends in person, you see the ups and downs. You know the good and bad. You know how hard they worked to win that prize or thing. It doesn't seem effortless. So that's why from a mental health point, and, you know, I'm a filmmaker. I'm seeing people get funding all the time, winning bigger awards than me all the time, everything all the time. It's a highly competitive space. It doesn't really make me feel happy to see that. I'm happy for my friends and I know how hard they work, but I'd way rather go for drinks with them. You know what I mean? And that's why I rarely post. Like we post a couple trailers for Anything for Fame. But there's so many like amazing moments, highlights, other things that we just didn't post. Cause I'm like, I'm not trying to brag. I'd love people to watch my film. I'm grateful to everyone who watches my film. Like I really, getting an hour of people's time is amazing. And I use it a little bit for that in the marketing thing. But I think just for the mental health thing, I think it's one of the least healthy platforms because of its design. I think in a lot of ways, TikTok is way better. You're seeing people around the world. You're going to fall into your own niche. The algorithm's so smart. If you want to watch whatever niche you want to watch, it'll get you there. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing entertainers. It's actually more of watching entertainers. Instagram, because it's your personal circle, you're just getting the highlight feeds from people in your life. It's not a great experience. And it's less dialogue than Facebook, where Facebook has a lot of the same problems, but there's a bit more of like a text conversation back and forth going on there. Instagram, I really think, is kind of just flexing.
Mm-hmm. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Keith, but aren't the statistics on email marketing campaigns way more higher closure rate than anything online? Like,
yeah.
I know it's traditional, but I've always coached like the people I mentored stuff that like build your email following. An engaged email following is worth gold compared to any other following you could possibly cultivate.
Yeah, I have some friends that did a ton of e-commerce for a board game, actually. And it was all their emailing list was how all, you know, and really impressive numbers. But it was the emailing list was the core part of that campaign that converted people and kept them around.
Wow. Fascinating.
We typically look to see like 20% of revenue through online coming through email and organic, social, incidental.
Wow. Okay, Gordon. Thanks, Gordon. Email RI. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, Tyler. This has been extraordinary. And really to everyone who's sort of jumped on board, we're going to keep this momentum going. I think generally speaking, people want to learn, and they want to learn and they sort of can generally find their own pathway. So we're going to try to provide as many learning opportunities as we can. Tyler, if you don't mind, you're going to be on our mailing list and you might consider, hopping on the odd time. You are Vancouver based, you're BC based. We're gonna promote you. We're gonna promote what you've done, and really thank you for providing us some time. I'm gonna put the Facebook. This is kind of our website. We're not gonna. Oh, thank you, Kelly, for creating that. But certainly, I'm gonna announce things on there, and across market with the website. I know Al. He's got an active content creation business running. He's also the CEO of the Chamber, so I know they're going to try to help us. So to all of you, we will provide more learning opportunities for sure. Tyler, this has been wonderful.
Great. I'm so glad to meet you guys all. And, you know, again, just my opinions. I could be wrong on a lot of it. You know, I love chatting with all you guys. And, yeah. Sorry to run. I got another meeting coming up, but
oh,
taking the time. Thank you, everyone. It's always fun.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tyler.
Tyler.
See y'all. I will be in touch. And
thanks,
we'll keep
y'all.
Learning.
Tyler.
Thank you, everyone.